You guys, time once again for my Tomes of Terror book review show. So the book we're talking about today was published in 2020 and pretty much immediately started getting like a shit ton of buzz. This author's been around for a really long time and his books always kind of like generate a lot of buzz generally, and it ended up winning several awards. The book I'm talking about is The Only Good Indians by Stephen Graham Jones. And look, again, I have a print copy. Yes, I bought this at Barnes and Noble not too long ago. Now, the awards that it ended up winning in 2020, it won the Ray Bradbury Prize, it won the Bram Stoker Award, the Shirley Jackson Award, and a couple of other ones as well. Now, Stephen Graham Jones has written a fuck ton. That's a scientific term. I had only read a couple of his. I read Night of the Mannequins, which is a novella, and that came out the same year as this one, I think a little bit earlier, which I really, really liked. I think I reviewed it on this series, matter of fact. The other book of his that I read was actually The Last Final Girl, which came out back in 2012, and I ended up not finishing it because I just couldn't get into it. It was kind of like a slasher type thing, and the writing style was just kind of like too much. It was kind of, yeah, so I couldn't really get into it, and I was like, well, so I just didn't finish it. But I will say that this book in particular, because it got so much praise, I was like, well, it kept getting recommended and everything. Okay, well, I really, really do have to read that. It seems like everybody loves this. And I ended up really, really liking it as well. I mean, I feel like most of the reviews are like overwhelmingly positive, but there are a couple people that just like didn't like it or didn't get it or didn't finish it. I get that, but I ended up really, really liking it. Although I will say that I think the first part of the book is actually a lot stronger and more entertaining than the second part of the book. But overall, I actually really, really did enjoy this. So the novel kind of reads more like a series of interconnected novellas, sort of, rather than kind of like a single cohesive narrative. Like, what I mean by that is there's like a brief prologue, and then there are kind of like three long sections that follow three different characters. But all the stories are sort of like centered on the same series of events. Like, these are all people that know each other, so it's not like, yeah, they're completely like interconnected. I will say too that though there are some absolutely like brutal scenes in this that are like really like gory and upsetting and gruesome, this is pretty much overwhelmingly more like a slower burn, more, I don't want to say like literary because people might get to it, but it is does have like a literary bent to it, and it's a much more like character-based horror. And it's also something like, it also has a lot of black humor to it, which I actually like quite enjoyed. And it's sort of like, aside from being kind of like a monster revenge type story, it's also sort of a little bit of a literary exploration of sort of like guilt and like cultural identity, how you can't escape your past, stuff like that. So as I said, plot-wise, it's essentially a revenge story. The antagonist or the monster or whatever being a sort of like mythological creature who is righting a wrong that has been done to her by humans. Now, I will say that the writing style of this and the kind of like vernacular that he uses, it took me a few pages to get into it. But after a few pages, I got used to it. Like I said, I kind of feel like I had the same issue with The Last Final Girl, although he wrote that in a different style that was just not like vibing with me. This one, I think it was just more getting used to like kind of catching the wave of like his narrative voice, I guess. So here's what we have. So the prologue of the story, as I mentioned earlier, kicks off with a guy named Richard Boss Ribs, or Ricky for short. He is Blackfeet, and he originally comes from a reservation, I believe is in Montana, but he ran off to work on an oil rig in North Dakota after his brother overdosed. He's at this bar one night getting like pretty epically drunk, as one does. And he goes out into the parking lot to take a leak. I guess like the bathrooms inside are full and he like really, really has to pee. So he's like, fuck it, I'm just gonna go outside. And then there's kind of an altercation where they're like, well, you can't come back in here because there's a big line. And he's like, whatever, I just need to go out and pee or whatever. So he goes out there to take a piss in the parking lot. And then he sees some pretty bizarre shit. This seemingly crazed elk kind of staggers into the lot. and starts crashing into a bunch of these pickup trucks that belong to, like, a lot of the good old boys that are inside. So the trucks get all dented up, like, all of the car alarms start going off. It's a whole situation. And because of the noise, like, all of the good old boys inside come piling out of the bar, and they don't actually see an elk. What they see is this lone, very drunk Native American man kind of stumbling around in the parking lot amid all of their damaged vehicles. And so they assume that he's done it in some kind of rage. So they chase Ricky into a field, and he's running, but then he sees, like, out ahead of him, he sees, like, all these glittering eyes, and it turns out it's this big, like, herd of elk that are essentially, like, trapping him or, like, hemming him in. So all the white guys from the bar, like, pretty much jump on him and essentially beat him to death. So after this kind of, like, relatively brief prologue, the story then shifts to another man named Lewis A. Clark. Because his parents were apparently comedians. Lewis is also, as you learn, from the same reservation as Ricky. The two of them were actually old friends. They went way back. But he has managed to move away from it. Basically just like Ricky has. He's married to a white woman named Peeta. And he has a job with the Postal Service. And his wife is like an aircraft marshaller. She's like one of the people that, you know, guides in the planes with the lights and everything like that. Yeah, she does that. They live, like, a fairly working class, but a very decent life. They have, like, a nice house they just rented, and they have a dog that they love very much named Harley. Shortly after, though, there appears kind of a wrinkle in all of this domestic bliss. So there's an indigenous woman named Shaney, who's a co-worker of Lewis's. Now, she's Crow, and he's Blackfeet, and there's kind of, like, a long history of antagonism between their two tribes. But in spite of this, Shaney befriends him, and even seems to kind of low-key flirt with him at times, which he's a little bit weirded out by, but he does like her, like, she's a nice lady. And the whole situation, though, is made, like, slightly more awkward by the fact that all of their co-workers, who are all white, they've kind of got into their head, it's like, oh, you two are the only Indians that work here, like, on the staff, so therefore you two are made for each other and should, like, go out. And they don't really seem to care that Lewis is, like, already happily married, so there's that. Yeah, so it's this big weird thing, and his wife is also just kind of like, what the fuck, what is going on with this? But yeah. However, there is one thing from his past that Lewis has never shared with his wife. And he ends up telling it to Shaney because he thinks she'll have a better understanding of sort of like the impact of it. So it turns out that 10 years prior to the events of the book, when he was just like an older teenager, Lewis and his three friends, who included Ricky, the guy that was beaten to death earlier, and two other guys named Gabriel Crossguns, Gabe for short, and Cassidy Sees Elk, known as Cassidy for short, did something they really shouldn't have done. So being kind of young and rebellious and being like, whatever, fuck it, they deliberately went out into the reservation's elder hunting grounds, where they are absolutely not allowed to go. Like, only the elders are allowed to hunt there, and I think it's even, like, toward the end of the season, but they're absolutely not allowed to hunt there at all. So they go there, like, on the sly, and they go up on this ridge, and they look down into, like, the valley below, and there's a massive, massive herd of elk down there, and they're just kind of, like, ripe for the picking. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. And they're super, super excited. They're like, oh my god, think of all of the elk meat that we will have in the freezer all winter long. We don't even have to hunt all winter. It's like, we'll have everything. So they're, like, super jazzed. So they basically end up just shooting into the herd. And they kill 9 elk in this big bloody eruption of gunfire. So they go down to the valley to kind of retrieve their spoils. And then they discover that one of the elk, a female, isn't quite dead. And they have to end up kind of like filling her full of more. Like, they shoot her again and she still doesn't die. And then, like, they blow her head off and she's still kind of like kicking. And they're like, what the fuck? You know what I mean? But finally she does die. She was really real. They were like, why the hell was she so reluctant to die? We've never seen that before. But the reason for this soon becomes clear, in that the elk is pregnant. and was basically fighting for her baby's survival. She was trying to, like, curl around her belly while they were trying to shoot her. Now, the boys know that it's too early in the season for her to be pregnant, and yet, here it is. She's obviously pregnant. Lewis feels absolutely awful about killing her, and ends up taking out her baby and burying it, like, trying to respect the baby, and also vows to her, I will use every bit of you, like, to honor your legacy, honor your sacrifice. So he wants to do that. Now, it turns out that when the boys go back up to the ridge carrying all their, like, dragging all their meat or whatever, the game warden, Denny, catches them and basically forces them. He's like, well, you can't keep that. You're not supposed to be here, so you have to throw all the meat back. And he's like, basically, you're all banned from, like, hunting around here ever again, pretty much. So all of the elk deaths ended up being essentially for nothing. It was just, like, all a big waste. Although Denny does concede to let Lewis keep the female, like, the special one that he killed. So he's like, fine, just keep it. But you have to throw all the other ones back. Now, for a long time, Lewis has seemingly been able to make good on his promise to use all of this slaughtered elk. Like, he butchers her and he puts all the meat in packets and he keeps some of it himself or eats it and then, like, or he sells a lot of it to other people on the reservation. And it seems like that's okay. He keeps the hide for himself. And for 10 years, his life goes along just fine. But it so happens, or you don't know if this actually happened, or this is maybe probably what happened and why it took 10 years for this shit to happen, is that he did sell, there was kind of a funny thing where he sells the meat to other people in the reservation. I guess there's kind of a thing where you put, like, a stamp on it, like, saying what kind of meat it is, like, what kind of animal it is. And the only stamp that he had available, like, belonged to a kid, like his niece or some shit like that, that was, like, a raccoon. It was like a raccoon paw. So some people thought it was raccoon meat and that it was like this thing. Okay, so, but most of the meat did get used, but apparently 10 years later, somebody on the reservation, like after he had already moved away, was cleaning out their freezer and sees this. He's like, what is this? Like old raccoon meat, and throws it out, meaning that he didn't use all of the elk like he promised to. So this apparently is what sets this supernatural revenge epic into motion. Now, after Lewis tells Shani all about this elk hunt, weird things start happening around the house. I mean, weird things that started happening before that, which is one of the reasons that he told Shani, because he thought she would understand. But, like, weirder shit, like, ramps up after that. Like, he starts hearing what sounds like footsteps or maybe hooves, like, creaking on the stairs outside. He thinks he's, like, up on a ladder trying to fix something, and he, like, peers down through the ceiling fan, like, the ceiling fan blades, which are spinning, and he thinks he sees the dead elk, like, laying in his living room. And so he's starting to, like, lose his marbles a little. He's like, what the fuck is going on here? And he starts thinking back to that long ago elk hunt. It's like, you know, maybe there's some, like, bad fucking mojo coming back to get me. And then, most horribly of all, so again, like, animal cruelty, if you really, there's a lot of fucked up shit happening to animals in this, so I'm just, like, warning you. So, most horribly of all, his dog, Harley, is stomped to death by some person or thing in the garage. After this, Lewis kind of starts going down this rabbit hole of, you know, what could be paranoia or, you know, probably not, like, as you learned later on. He actually first suspects his wife and then suspects Shani of being sort of like the agent of vengeance that has come to sort of, like, cash in his tab, I guess, or, like, get revenge for this shit that he did a long time ago. So this section of the book ends, I don't want to say abruptly, but it ends, like, really, really savagely, really gruesomely. And this part was actually, like, easily the most entertaining part of the story. And it's also probably, like, the grisliest part of the story, although there is some gory shit happens later on. So after this section of the book ends, we then go back to the reservation and into the tale of the two remaining friends that are still alive, Gabe and Cassidy. Now, neither one of them moved away from the reservation, and they've established somewhat satisfying lives within those parameters. Cassidy lives in a trailer with his girlfriend, Jolene, or Joe, who is also a Crow woman, just like Shani. And the couple are kind of like saving up money, like either to get out of there or to get married or whatever it is. You know, they both have jobs and shit like that. Now, Gabe is divorced and he's a little bit of a drunk and a little bit of a troublemaker, but he's still kind of a good guy. But he's actually really, really proud of his teenage daughter, whose name is Denora. And she is like this amazing basketball superstar, like at the school. And everybody is pretty much convinced that she's going to get a full scholarship, and she's maybe even gonna like be in the sports history book someday because she's like supernaturally like awesome at it, right? But again, I mean, they kind of think after they hear about what happened to Ricky, like getting beat to death outside the bar, and what happened to Lewis, which I don't really want to spoil. They're kind of like, oh, well, that's just kind of like, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of defeatist kind of, you know, because life on the reservation is just so, you know, economically depressed, and there's like a lot of alcoholism and suicide and drug addiction and things like that. So they've almost kind of like come to this impasse where it's like, oh, well, you know, 80-90% of us are gonna die in horrible ways anyway, so what are you gonna do? Like, you know, they die in car crashes all the time because they're out doing stupid shit. And so they almost make gallows humor, like jokes about it. So they just think that the two guys that moved away, it's just like, oh, well, they just flipped out, or it's like, that's just what happens to people like us, you know what I mean? It's just that kind of thing. But it so happens, I mean, they've stayed there, and they seem like pretty content with their lives. But it turns out that the repercussions of that long ago elk hunt, which actually they had jokingly dubbed the Thanksgiving Classic because it took place like the Saturday before Thanksgiving, I think. Those repercussions are about to come due. And so the remaining two guys and their families as well kind of like fall into the crosshairs of this monster, essentially. She's like a shape-shifting, kind of horrifying monster, but she's still kind of oddly sympathetic because you know like the reasons behind what she's doing. She's basically called, and I'm not gonna try and pronounce the indigenous name because I'll just embarrass myself, but basically it translates to Elkhead Woman is what she is. So, The Only Good Indians, it's a book about many things. It's, like I said, it's essentially just like a straight revenge, like, monster type story. But, it's also kind of like, and it, as I said, it's not heavy-handed about it because it does have, like, a lot of black humor. But it's kind of like an examination of sort of like the contradictions, I guess, of modern tribal life, seeing how these sort of like ancient traditions and these kind of like stereotypical kind of things that people associate with living on a reservation clash with more current ideas of like what people actually do there, what the younger people are doing there. And it also kind of talks about how the past still has this kind of like devastating stranglehold on the present. Like, the four guys at the center of the story, they're not bad dudes, really. I mean, they're just regular people. But from the point of view of the avenging Elkhead Woman, these men were bad because they essentially visited her people, like, the elk, with the same kind of senseless violence that colonialist forces had always kind of, like, marshaled against them, against indigenous people. And it's kind of, like, repeating the cycle, and she's kind of trying to, like, you know, and she's also a part of the cycle of violence as well. And it's also kind of like, I guess, like an interesting examination of the cultural identity and sort of like deflating a lot of the stereotypes surrounding indigenous people in general and Blackfeet in particular. Stephen Graham Jones, by the way, the author is Blackfeet himself. And how kind of like growing up on the reservation has sort of like a profound effect on your whole entire outlook on life and how your life turns out, even if you try to escape it. So it's very much a past impacting the present, like how you can't really run from your past or escape from your past type of story. But as I said, you don't have to read all of that deep shit into it if you don't want to, because it is on its face just like a monster revenge story. So you can just read it on that level if you want to, but there's a lot of other stuff going on in there as well. So I would definitely recommend this if you're interested in more like literary horror, stories based around, you know, indigenous mythologies, things like that. As I mentioned, I think the first part of the book, the parts that were following Ricky and Lewis, were a lot stronger, a lot more gruesome, a lot more compelling than the later parts were that followed kind of more like Gabe and Cassidy and Denora. But it's all really good. It's very well written, very visceral, very atmospheric. And it's kind of like I said, there's a lot of black humor in it, which I really liked because that came, like, a lot from the characters about kind of, you know, examining their lot in life and making sort of, like, jokes about it, trying to make the best out of bad situations and things like that. So I kind of liked that tone of it as well. So overall, I thought this was pretty great. And let me know if you've read it. I feel like a lot of people have, and I can't believe it's taken me kind of like, I guess this came out almost 2 years ago, so it took me this long to get. I kept hearing about it and hearing about it, and I'm like, okay, well, I guess I gotta read this now, because it seems like everybody's read it but me. But yeah, so if you've read it, let me know what you think about it in the comments, or if it sounds interesting to you and you want to read it, let me know that too. And that will do it for this Tomes of Terror. I will see you guys on the next one. Bye.